Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Alexander Lemieux, a thought leader in circular economics, who is challenging what has initially developed as a resource-focused model to propose a circular economy 2.0, which he also calls a human-centered circular economy, by embedding two identified missing dimensions from the original, the social dimension and a measurement of value creation. Alexander is founder of Wise Impact, the co-founder of the African Circular Economy Network, and was a member of the Circular Economy Task Force at the World Economic Forum in 2016. I spoke to Alex online from his home in South Africa. So Alex, welcome to Change Hackers.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Listeners will have had to have been on holiday somewhere very, very remote to have not heard about circular economics in the last few years, not least through the efforts of people like Ellen MacArthur and Bill McDonough and others. And you've been a leading voice within that movement to advance the theory, to advance the thinking and thought leadership around it, and engagement and commitment from business sector, governments and so on. You bring a particular angle to it, and I really want to get into why the social dimension is so important to you. But before we do that, what I'd really like to do is sort of wind the clock back and explore, you know, what your first memories were of feeling that, firstly, environment and sustainability, but also social issues and sort of having a broader concern beyond your immediate surroundings, if you like, was something that you wanted to invest in.
When I was going to the primary school and driving past a steel bridge on the way to school, which was written "Free Mandela," "Free Nelson Mandela," and then I asked my parents about who was that Mandela guy and why was he in prison and what did he do wrong and things like that. And at the end, I ended up being in South Africa, living there, because I wanted to understand what was going on in this country. And I did a thesis on apartheid and the end of apartheid era, at the time when Nelson Mandela left prison. I lived in South Africa during his era, so between 1995 and 2000. And the reason behind that is that what is the common denominator between what I do today and what happened then was social injustice. I cannot stand social injustice. I cannot stand inequality and inequity, more preferably inequity. And I do believe, and I've seen so much, you know, I've traveled the world and I lived 16 years outside of my home country, France. I've seen the most advanced capitalistic model, which is the United Arab Emirates. I've seen the poverty across India, Africa, and the misbalance between the rich and the poor. And I know from the economic standpoint, and this is very well explained in Kate Raworth's The Dognut Economy, that the economic model and the way it's been thought about it is far, far away from the trickle-down economic model where when the people at the top make so much money, the people at the bottom will also make money. I mean, this is all wrongly designed. And I see social injustice in circular economy, whereas it shouldn't be there. For the simple reason, and I will try to make it very simple, is that circular economy is a distributive economic model. Therefore, there's no more, multinational linear economic model as we know them today, but rather fully distributive small or localized corporate units, as in a truly designed and well-designed circular model. So this is an opportunity to see the social or human-centered economic model back again and designed away from the economic thinking of the 20th century. And circular economy, if we truly follow this model as of a distributive economy, we can design an economy which grants equal or equitable chances for anyone on the planet to access the economy and to access well-being, basically.
Okay, we'll get more into this, but before we do, I'm interested in just getting into why does this become your problem to address? Can you give us a sense of why it's so important for you to be focusing on this?
I understand that this interview is also made to give advices to people or to influence paths that people may take. And my career and my path has been influenced by Nelson Mandela. And if I have an advice to share is that please identify yourself with someone, a leader, or it might not be a leader, but someone who has a strong influence on your social norms, on your personality, and on who you want to become one day in your life, no matter what it takes in terms of professional decisions or even personal decisions. And to me, it was that man. And behind that,
did you ever get to meet him?
Yes, I met him, and every time I talk about it, I've got tears in my eyes, but. I met him at the Telecom, Africa Telecom, in 1999. While I was on having my break, I was then working at Alcatel, what was called Alcatel-Lucent recently, in the telecom industry. And I had the break around 10 o'clock in the morning. And I was outside of the exhibition hall in Johannesburg, and he had finished his official introductory discourse, and I didn't realize I was next to this car. He just came out of the building, and I was really next to him. Showed me his hand to shake, and I was so impressed that I never managed to shake his hand back. So this is a major regret, but a truly impressive moment at the same time. So yes, and this man has influenced all my life, because now I'm married to an African lady, and my kids are half Africans. So racism is my problem. My children are of both culture, and the future of Africa becomes my future. And and also because I understand from traveling the interlinkages between continents. I mean, the future of Europe cannot be without the future of Africa. And when you see all the migrants issues that we are discussing in Europe, without fully understanding the reason behind those imbalances, therefore you cannot allow to welcome a new economic model without making sure it embeds all dimensions and design a new economic model properly this time. Doesn't mean circularity of materials only, but the social dimension should be embedded within it. But I know we will talk about it later. But yeah, basically, in a nutshell, Tony, you identify yourself with a leading personality. You go and see by yourself, learn from experience what's the reality on the ground, and then you, once you have identified with those experiences on the ground, you try to solve them and you try to sort them out. We are a generation, I believe. I don't think you are far out from my age, but we are a generation of the crisis. Our parents come from the 60s, where everything was booming, the economic model was booming. We come from the 70s and the 90s, and we have experienced different economic crises, and this is getting worse and worse and worse. And there are people who can, as you said, live with that and be happy in their daily life without having to solve anything. But there are other people who are there to act and to say things and to do things and to change those things. And I believe you and I are part of these people, and we cannot bear the situation that we've seen. And it happens to me that I lived in a township for nearly 2 months near Johannesburg, and I've seen things with gunshots and poverties, and I mean, that was crazy. That was nonsense. And I'm lucky enough to live in a house that is, with all the meanings around the house. But living in instability every day because of poverty, because of inequality, inequity, and is unbearable. And from that social injustice, I decided to have a say on that.
I think there's a pattern here for me that other people I've spoken to in other episodes who have had formative backgrounds, you know, growing up in Berlin when the wall was still there, or growing up in Beirut in amongst conflict. It has such a profound effect, not just on your perspective on those issues, but just as importantly on creating motive for you to channel it into something positive. It's a furtive breeding ground for change agents. If only they can find something positive to focus on. So I'm curious then, from that powerful, profound motive in the first place, the inspiration that Mandela's been for you, the impact and influence he's had on shaping your ambition, your mission at a personal level, how that translates into focusing in on economics, first of all?
Well, again, it's all a matter of your pathway and where it takes you. I mean, you have that within you. You have all this experience, apartheid, the racism. I've been to Berlin to visit the Berlin Wall in the 1990s. I've been to Beirut for many years now. I was even at on the way to the Beirut airport 2 years ago when there was a bombing on that road to the airport. I was in Zagreb when there was the war in the Balkans. You have all these experiences, and I even crossed the African continent backpacking from South Africa to the Middle East, back to Europe. So I've seen things. I've seen extreme poverty in Ethiopia. I've seen, unbearable situations. So these are things that are within you. Then you decide to either take, education is one way to do it, gaining a diploma in a specific field is one way to implement and to make to turn it concrete actions from what you've seen. And that's what I did when I started again an MBA to see what is the latest in terms of economic development, economics, and to understand where to invest my time next. Then I decided to go for becoming an accredited practitioner in social impact analysis, assessment, based on economic data, understand why the economic system is in such a way and why we cannot lift people off poverty, or why people on one hand getting developed and richer, how they create poverty on the other hand, and how it's possible. So you decide on investing in that field of interest of yours. And I was lucky enough to do that in parallel of my job. I was then at Cisco Systems. And then Cisco Systems was the first funding company of the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. So again, on your pathway, there are milestones. And if you are opportunistic enough, you just catch them. And back in 2010, Cisco was discussing with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. And obviously, I was part of the entrepreneurship group at Cisco. So we were about 30 people within Cisco working within a virtual group because we were dispersed across the globe, discussing innovative activities within the company, even to change the company within it and to change ourselves at the same time. And I ended up in discussion with them, Ellen MacArthur at the time, to create the foundation, the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. And then I grabbed the opportunity and I was like waiting for Cisco to create that circular economy director jobs. And it didn't come soon enough. So I started my company and I said, okay, circular economy. The first question I asked Dame Ellen MacArthur then was, Ellen, do you think circular economy will have an impact on poverty? That was my first question. She couldn't answer that question because obviously it was too early and the Ellen MacArthur Foundation's main objective is not poverty, but that's what I saw straight away. And because of my experience, because of what I've learned from the different experiences that I've been having in different countries, that was the main reason why I jumped into the circular economy, because I saw the distributive nature of the model, and because I knew that there was something to be done on the social dimension.
Okay, so there'll be people listening who recognize that dilemma when you're working as an entrepreneur in a large organization, where you reach a point where you think you've got as far as you can get in terms of pursuing this idea or this thing that's become your focus from within the relative safety of a large organization. So what was the crunch point for you in terms of deciding, right, I need to go off on my own and do this independently?
The crunch point was after a year of investing in the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, that my company was not walking the talk, if I could say that, by not investing in the model internally. I mean, we had no sign whatsoever that there was any investments or to change the way the company was run. And the frustration was not only at my level, but at the level of the gentleman who was running the entrepreneurship group globally at Cisco, because he saw his job, his role within that group being questioned by the company itself. And with another colleague of mine, she was at the time as well in that entrepreneurship group, and she also started her own company. I didn't know about that at that time, but then we, 1 year later, we realized that we took the same decision at the same time, based on the same frustration, not seeing the things change in reality, whereas in all press releases, you could see how good was these activities with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. So the frustration come from that point on, that I could not expect to see any position being creating anytime soon within that company. And I then decided that I had enough, I knew enough, I had enough exposure, I had my MBA in my pocket. I had my social impact accreditation as a practitioner in my pocket. I could see the vision of my company, which was designed back in 2012, and which is still very much ahead of the curve in 2018, because the vision of my company is about measuring the impact and the social return of a company, project, product, service. And once we understand this societal return of this service of this product, inclusive of the cost, the benefits, the negative externalities, the positive externalities of that product or that service, then we implement circular economic principles according to the societal return, so embedding the social dimension. And implementing just the circular economic principle was no longer enough. I had to integrate social dimension at the same time, because I could see that your product or your service, your circular services, you sell them to people. And if you don't embed people's needs, and if you don't change the mindset of people so that they take the right decision by choosing a service which has a lesser environmental impact, then you will never succeed in your search for a better climate or search for a less impactful world, or unless you embed the people within it, because they are the key and they are the relation between your economics and your environmental. So missing that link, and we will be missing the fact that, if I talk circular economy, the fact that we want circular economy to be used as widely as possible around the globe. It shouldn't be a VIP model, otherwise it will stay within our sphere. It should be a people on the street model that is appealing to everybody. Failure to do that.
So on that point, take that challenge. For people listening who are thinking circular economy, I've kind of heard of that. I'm not really sure what it is. How would you simply describe it?
The simplest way to describe it would be to mimic natural cycles. Okay, in three words. Now it's a bit difficult to imagine that. So the circular economy is about decoupling your need for resources, so the mineral material resources that you element that you extract from the ground, so reducing that needs and still making sure that your so-called economic growth is going, sorry, I don't like that word, that's why it's growing well. Okay, so it's some kind of translation to some kind of well-being model, which is somehow wrong, but basically, how can we survive on a planet with 10 billion people with the same amount of resources without extracting further, okay, and still ensuring the well-being of the people on this planet? That's how the circular economy is designed.
So circular economics was, if not a son or daughter of sustainable development, it's a very closely related philosophy and concept and approach. That being the case, why do you think it was that, to begin with, circular economics neglected the whole social dimension?
Well, it's still neglected today, so I can't talk about the past. It's still the case today. I used to be a Global Reporting Initiative trainer at the time, and I used to be in sustainable development, providing training, making corporations aware of this model, and it was always very difficult to convince corporations. It was easy to convince the CSR, the corporate social responsibility director, but to convince the CEO of a company, it was barely impossible, because sustainable development was the good to have, the good to talk about, but was nothing near the interest of corporations. So it was a difficult discussion to have and very frustrating. When circular economy came into the radar, mainly thanks to the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, but also thanks to Professor Walter Stahel, Bill McDodo, and with the cradle-to-cradle concept, it made more economic sense, and it made more sense to companies. Why? Because we were talking about corporate resilience. We were talking about, guys, I mean, if you don't feed your factories with recovered materials, maybe at some point you will not have enough raw materials to feed your companies and to provide your products to the market. So all of a sudden, it became a core strategic decision to be made at the company. Unfortunately, while this is very much happening, and while this has been happening for some time, before 2010, the connection between the depleting resources and the survival of companies was very weak. I mean, we could still abuse of the linear economy. Since 2010, we see the connection, but there is no incentive. Companies are asked to invest into that model. Therefore, there is a lot of marketing and press releases exercise, but the investments are not happening as they should. And until such time, you set up a framework where you incentivize those companies for the positive externalities. So the fact that you move a car without generating CO2, for instance, is a positive externality. And failure to do that, you will not see a lot of companies jumping into that new circular economic model. The fact that circular economics was not appealing before 2010 was because the connection between resource depletion and the survival or the resilience of the company's economic model or strategies was very weak before that. I mean, Walter Stahel is the best example on performance economy. He's been talking about a sub-model of circular economies since the 1970s. He's been talking about that while without having the attention that he has nowadays. So, and since 2010, with the researches and the surveys that were done by the big consultancy companies, we realized that resource depletion was a harsh reality, and it was going exponentially high, and especially before 2050. And if companies were not changing their strategies of extracting, transforming raw materials into products for single use before disposing of these products, if they continue alongside that path, they might face the risk of not feeding their factories back again with raw materials in order to make their products. So there's been they've been realizing that, and there's been a wake-up call since 2010. But what we see in reality is that the investment are still not at the level required, for one simple reason, is that there is no incentivation of the good behavior, of incentivation of the positive externalities that the company could generate. Like, for instance, if I make car, how do I move my car from a point A to a point B without generating CO2? This is what we call positive externalities. And failure to incentivize companies on these positive externalities, you will not see the required level of investment in that new circular economic model.
Right. This applies equally to the commons, I guess, as well, in terms of natural resources, be it water, air, and so on. It seems to me, I mean, and this has been brought into sharp relief recently with the situation in South Africa on water, that it takes a burning platform to force people, not just individual organizations, but society level, to actually start taking action and taking an issue seriously.
Yeah, and another aspect of circular economy is that it should, I mean, from a design perspective, I mean, it's about designing your system well. You are in a world of 10 billion people. There is less water. There is more climate change. There is less environmental functions. There are more people, and there is less material. So you need to also design your new system with the right tax and incentive approach. Okay, you cannot just tax. You also have to incentivize the good behavior. And unfortunately, environmental function will have to be taxed. I mean, the water, as being an environmental function, will have to have a higher cost so that we care for water. Yeah. The missing raw materials, or what we call the rare earths, will have to be taxed. Some people are saying we should tax robots. If you tax robots, you tax technological advances, and therefore it's the wrong approach. But if you tax rare earths and resources that are going scarce, then you are taxing the right thing, because people will start thinking about creating feedback loops so that they can get those rare earths or raw material that are going scarce back into their factories. By taxing them, you will change the behavior and the flows back into the factories. The same thing for water, the same thing for the people. The people and the labor, people are in abundance in this planet. We move from 7 to 10 billion people, and then hopefully there will be a decrease in the global population. Therefore, you should remove tax on the people. And that's my point with the proposed human sphere in the circular economy. Is that
so? Where do you think circular economics has got stuck then? Do you think it's just, you know, like many nascent proposals that have come before, it just takes time to move them from being nascent to eventually becoming institutionalized and socialized? And we need to be realistic about how long that will take? Or, you know, are the specific things you think that, you know, give us clues to why circular economics so far hasn't really been adopted at the kind of scale it needs to be?
Well, it's we talk circular economy with our linear economic thinking. Therefore, we talk efficiency instead of effectiveness of systems. Okay, we talk about how do we cut on costs instead of how do we create endless flows and endless access to resources. So the strategy and the thinking should be completely different. The circular economy brings you the tools, and it didn't get stuck, in my view, because it's an open systems with principles, with open concept. So in my view, it's not stuck. It's just missing some blocks. And the people behind the concept of circular economy are claiming that those blocks have been left empty on purpose so that we can adapt and customize them the way we want them to be customized. But the point is that it's still very much, the way companies use that circular economic model is used in very linear way with effectiveness in mind. Yeah. And we need to focus more on efficiencies of flows and efficiencies of access to stock. And when you look at efficiency, then all of a sudden you identify roles of the people on this planet that could be different, that they could play that role of the missing environmental function. And they could play that role of maintaining those raw materials for longest time possible. Obviously, not the way we used to work back in those days, but in new ways, in new approach to management of energy and management of resources. And in my view, it's not stuck. It's just that we fear that having people back in the commands of the company could be risky, whereas they don't see that having robots only at the commands of companies is maybe efficient but not effective. Robots are made of elements, are made of raw materials, and where are we going to find those raw materials in an economy that depends exclusively on robots? That's the question.
At a personal level, you've made a very deliberate choice to pursue something that is, by definition, not an overnight impact. It's a big, audacious goal you're going after, working at a societal level, not just at an organisational level. How do you keep yourself motivated, driven, focused to keep pursuing that when the rewards back to you, you know, are incremental?
That's a good question, Tony, because every day I wonder why I say the things that I say. But anyway, there is a great personal cost. I cannot hide it. I won't go into details, but there is a great personal cost to that decision. And there is also questions that I ask myself on a daily basis, whereas what direction will this take and under what form? And sometimes you are highly disappointed with the reaction of people. Sometimes you wonder if that direction, if it can, if the wording used can be improved. And I'm working with some people on that. So, because how do you keep motivating yourself? I mean, it's because you believe in your inner you, inside of you. You know that this is the right decision. You know this is the right future. I have two boys, and I know that the future for my two boys should be a future where the humans are embedded in the next economic model, generating genuine value. How are we going to go there? Obviously, nobody knows really. But I know that from the feedback I receive from the many people reacting to my suggestions, I mean, it keeps you motivating. Obviously, motivation is not there every day, and sometimes you wonder why this is so difficult. But you know inside of you that this is the right thing. There is only one way to go, and this is this way. And I'm not against technological advances. I follow the technological advances. I follow all of this. But I know that a decision-making process without embedding humans somehow within that process will be doomed to fail. It's been true in the past. It's going to be true in the future. And if someone had a very genuine idea about the rosy future for everybody, that person would have, we would have seen that person before, and challenges would not have been the challenges that we are facing today. So nobody has the right, the magic wand or the magic stick, but at least we can try. And that's when you believe in that, you believe that you have a say in a distributive economy, you believe you have a say in a world where we as citizens, we have the power of the media, we can say something that has very tremendous reputation and tremendous impact. Therefore, we can say things. Therefore, we can share our views. And if we believe that our views are the right one and are genuine, then we should say something. And that's where the motivation is coming from.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Thanks for having me, Tony. It's been great. A great discussion. Thanks again.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, change hackers.